All right, may it please the court.
You may proceed.
Your Honors, the search that was conducted in my client's case upon his arrest was illegal at the time it was conducted, and the good faith exception should not have applied to excuse the police conduct in that case. And as a result, as we know, the procedural posture here is that this is a ineffective assistance of counsel question. So I'm happy to get into those kind of procedural issues later on, but the standard of review relies upon whether the search was legal or not, what the Fourth Amendment question was.
Isn't the issue whether or not the counsel is ineffective or not? I mean, that's the real issue in this matter.
It is, Your Honor. But the standard of review for a Fourth Amendment ineffectiveness claim is whether the Fourth Amendment issue is meritorious. So really it comes down to what the limits were at the time of the search and at the time of the trial on the search incident to arrest exception. And as this court pointed out, now I know that everyone pronounces it differently. I say Kimmel. That's just because my criminal procedure professor said that that way. But this court pointed out in Carawell that Kimmel, from 1969, I believe it was, defined the only, quote, only justifications for the search incident to arrest exception. Those justifications then create the limits around that exception, which are that it has to be the person of the arrestee or the area within the arrestee's immediate control. There's no question in this case that the cigarette container that was taken off, that was allegedly taken off my client, was searched well outside of those parameters.
But isn't this case more similar to Robinson?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think it can be distinguished on its facts. And we can talk about what power Robinson actually would have in these circumstances anymore. But in the Robinson case, I think it's really important to note that the Robinson search itself would have been justified under Kimmel. The Robinson search doesn't require extra justification because the officer in that case was standing, quote, face-to-face with the arrestee when the search was conducted. It was conducted clearly and unambiguously during the course of that arrest. In this case, we're talking about a container that it was impossible for the arrestee to possibly have reached into at the time of the search.
Was there probable cause to search the cigarette container based on the defendant's statement that he possessed marijuana?
Your Honor, the defendant's statement that he possessed marijuana was followed immediately by a search of his person, which located that marijuana.
Just because he had other marijuana doesn't mean that they have to assume the cigarette pack didn't include marijuana.
Your Honor, I would agree that they wouldn't have to assume that. I would also, though, state that this court can't assume, and the courts can't necessarily assume that probable cause did exist. There was no evidence of any kind of additional probable cause. All of the testimony here justified the search solely on the basis of a search incident to arrest.
Is probable cause a subjective determination of the officers, or is it objective from the circumstances?
It's an objective from the circumstances, Your Honor, but I don't believe that in these circumstances the record would support it. There just wasn't any kind of additional testimony that would support any additional probable cause once that has. And
so is it your argument that the difference between here and Robinson is that there the personal items and effects were on the person, but here was a half hour later and they were put in a separate hotel room, so they shouldn't be distinguished from other items seized and should need a warrant?
Yes, Your Honor. The circumstances here weren't just that they were separated. It was actually very similar to Gantt in that the arrestee had been, and this is unambiguous, the arrestee had been secured. The scene had been secured. The cigarette pack was not only placed in a separate area, but it was under guard while it was in this separate area. There was another officer who was guarding that door. there just simply was, it was simply impossible under all of the testimony and the entire record for the arrestee here to have been able to access that cigarette pack.
But in Robinson, later followed by O'Reilly, the court said in doing so, the court did not draw a line between the search of Robinson's person and a further examination of the cigarette pack found during that search. They seem to imply that that difference in time or that later search didn't make a difference.
Yes, Your Honor. And so I would say upon rereading Robinson, Robinson kind of allows that without deciding it. It doesn't actually state that as the, quote, you know, personal effects found on the person as a rule. It just assumes that the personal effects are a part of the person. However, again, I would assert that any kind of statement like that would have been in dicta, in that that search in Robinson was justifiable under Kimmel, really unambiguously. So there's not a need for an extra rule, and you know, additionally, it.
But Riley followed that same line, and albeit it was a cell phone, but they followed that same line of analysis.
You know, I think that Riley did not actually do so, and what's interesting about Riley, and this is where, respectfully, I believe the state is overstating the case as to how much Riley actually approved of Robinson. Riley states that Robinson states the Robinson rule, acknowledges that it's there, but then the entire discussion of the search incident to arrest after that places Robinson and places everything else within the context of the Kimmel justifications and the Kimmel rule. So, you know, while it pays lip service to Robinson, I don't believe that it goes so far as the state is saying, and that it actually approves of or reaffirms the rule of Robinson, and it certainly doesn't apply the rule of Robinson. It goes in a completely separate direction and says cell phone data is not something that even applies under these circumstances. So, you know, our position, I understand we basically have two discussions here, the first of which is that our position is that the exclusionary rule should have applied, should have been applicable here, which as I put forward in our brief, that requires the court to reconsider that portion of the Carawell decision as to whether good faith could apply. The second part of this is the state's request that the court overturn that substantive portion of Carawell based on this kind of Robinson-esque idea that that personal effects should be subject to unlimited searches every single time someone is arrested in every single circumstance. We think that, pardon me, the first question is answered by the issue of whether the good faith exception should apply is whether this was objectively reasonable reliance upon binding appellate court precedent. As was mentioned earlier, and I believe Judge Stith brought up that we don't get to choose between the Court of Appeals and the United States Supreme Court. I think Gantt applied and clearly reiterated a long line of pretty unambiguous case law that set those limits. But additionally, those limits that are in Kimmel and are in Gantt are also the appropriate limits, not just because it's reasonable, and it is. Any kind of exception to the warrant requirement needs to flow from the purposes behind that exception. That's how Kimmel wrote those rules. But additionally, the way that Kimmel sets this out, it creates an easy categorical rule that applies in every arrest, that the person of the arrestee and the area within their immediate control is what you're allowed to search incident to arrest. Beyond that, unless it's justified by some other exception, then you need to get a warrant.
Sorry, I'm looking at Riley and its discussion of Robinson, and it says that they could search the cell phone to make sure, say, it didn't have a razor blade hidden someplace in the case, but not search the data, because data can endanger no one. And then they said, perhaps the same might have been said of the cigarette pack seized from Robinson's packet. Once an officer gained control of the pack, it was unlikely that Robinson could have accessed the pack's contents. But unknown physical objects may always pose risks, no matter how slight, during the tense atmosphere of a custodial arrest. The officer and Robinson testified he could not identify the objects in the pack, but knew they were not cigarettes. Given that, a further search was a reasonable protective measure. No such unknowns exist with respect to digital data.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So how do we apply that here?
So I believe the segment of Riley that you just read shows that the United States Supreme Court is reading Robinson narrowly. What it's saying here is that unknown physical objects may always pose risks. There was testimony, and it's referring to actual factual testimony in Robinson, that there were unknown objects that the officer could feel inside the pack. During the tense atmosphere of a custodial arrest, it was during the course of that arrest, unlike in this case. The officer testified he could not identify the objects in the cigarette pack, but knew they were not cigarettes. That's not the case here. And given that, given all of that that it just said, the Supreme Court is saying that a further search was a reasonable protective measure. It seems to me that the court is going out of its way here to talk about the reasonableness of the search in Robinson, and none of those justifications that it just read off are because they just simply have a right because it was a personal effect.
So in other words, they say if you think it's reasonable, if a reasonable officer would think that was necessary as a protective measure, Robinson and Riley say it's okay, but was such that kind of justification was not offered here. They didn't suggest they or a reasonable officer would have.
There was not. No, there was no indication that they had any kind of subjective belief that there was any danger or.
But subjective doesn't matter. But from the circumstances, they didn't claim below there was a reasonable officer would have thought they needed to search the cigarette pack as a protective measure.
No, not as a protective measure or anything beyond just the justifications for search incident to arrest. So there was nothing beyond. We thought we had a right because it was a personal effect, I believe is what was argued below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. In Riley, it's correct, the court talked about those sorts of justifications. But the court also pointed to the other stated reason in Robinson for allowing these searches, which is simply this. A custodial arrest of a suspect based on probable cause is a reasonable intrusion under the Fourth Amendment. That intrusion being lawful, a search incident to the arrest requires no additional justification. And
how long does that last, though? I mean, here it was half an hour. What if it was 2 days later and they went back there? Could they still do it? Where's the fact that it was found on your person, does that give you unlimited in time and scope right to search it without a warrant? And if not, how do we draw that line?
Well, I think that, you know, the Fourth Amendment always draws the line that if it's an unreasonable search. And so, you know,
how long was it in Edwards?
Pardon me?
How long was it in Edwards? It was hours.
Right. They there are situations where I think that and let me take one step back. I'm not sure that the time really matters when you're talking about personal effects that are on the person of the arrestee at the time of the arrest. I don't think it should ever matter. There doesn't need to be any additional justification because the body of the person has been subjected to a full custodial arrest. And when you
why does it matter where they were found if they're no longer on their body or within their? I'm just not understanding what the legal rationale for once they're separated from the person, how are they different from the suitcase?
Well, it's very different.
When they have it on their
right,
person.
Right. If we know that it's on their person and they are then taken down to the police station, in every case, that's going to be inventoried at the police station. It's going to be put into evidence. And so an inventory is going to take place. And so you know, because of that fact, I think that the court recognized in Robinson, when you have a full custodial arrest, whatever intrusion follows after that into, you know, the person, now obviously there are limits. You can't go into the vein, for instance, without a search warrant, but you can search the person. And you
think there's inevitable discovery, basically.
Essentially,
that wasn't done here, but
that's what the court held in Robinson, that the search of the person and the personal effects on the person of the arrestee is subsumed within the custodial arrest itself. And so those searches are per se reasonable if the arrest itself is reasonable.
And you're right, we rely pretty heavily on the Court of Appeals case, Ellis, that says that the search continues back at the police station.
And Ellis was relying on, you know, there have been various cases that talked about that, how the timing of the search of a personal effect taken from the arrestee's person isn't really the benchmark. It doesn't matter, because a search incident to arrest of the person and the personal effects on the person is permissible and has been permissible ever since Robinson was decided. And Robinson cited back to the Weeks case, which was decided in 1914, and said, hey, we've consistently held that when there is an arrest of the person, you can search that person and their personal effects.
So you, that rationale would require us to overrule Carowell, because we said once you're separated from the personal effects, then in fact you can't.
That aspect of Carowell, I believe, should be reconsidered, yes, because...
But if we don't reconsider it, then your rationale fails, doesn't it?
Right. If the court doesn't reconsider it and strictly applies the Carowell rule to the evidence taken from his person in this case, then arguably there was a basis to suppress this evidence. Although, I have to say, since this was evidence that was on his person, the police weren't going to just leave it there at the scene after they removed it from his body. Because if they do that, they're going to be subject to a subsequent claim that, hey, you took property off of my body and then you just discarded it and left it? No. They're going to move that down to the police station and it's going to be inventoried. So an inevitable discovery, I think, arises under the facts of this particular case. But even if...
Do we judge the reasonableness of counsel by the law today, Carowell, or do we judge it by what the law was when he was not filing the motion to suppress?
The latter, Your Honor. The law as it existed at the time. So even if Carowell is going to be strictly applied to the search in this case, counsel's not ineffective for failing to file that motion because Carowell didn't exist.
And didn't we make a similar finding in the Miners case?
You did, where counsel was alleged that counsel failed to instruct or offer I think it might have been challenge, the failure to give a lesser included offense instruction because the appellate law was in flux and the court said that counsel was not... couldn't be expected to anticipate the change that was brought about.
Your client or your opposing counsel responds that it doesn't matter because the only standard here is whether or not there was a meritorious claim.
Oh, it certainly matters, Your Honor. And I think in particular in light of Ellis, which had expressly rejected an application of Gantt to these sorts of things, the court said in Ellis, which was precedential authority at the time counsel would have been making this decision, that we see no Missouri case or any precedential case or binding case that extends Gantt to the searches of this type.
And Carowell was not decided until 2016, is that right?
That's right.
And the direct appeal in this case had a suppression motion been filed, denied, and litigated on direct appeal, Carowell would still not have been litigated at that point.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So go ahead.
Would you address whether there was probable cause simply because the defendant stated in response to a question that he had marijuana on his person?
I would think an argument could definitely be made that if he said he had marijuana on his person, the officers would have probable cause to believe that he had marijuana on his person.
And to search anything within which marijuana could be hidden?
I would think so. Incident to the arrest. I mean, you still have to have an exception to the warrant requirement, even when there's probable cause to conduct a search. But the ordinary exception in cases where somebody admits that they have contraband on their body is the search incident to arrest. The historical basis, I think that the Kimmel rationales, they can certainly be looked at in a case like this and viewed as additional reasons to uphold the reasonableness of a search. And they talked about that in Riley. But they also talked about the traditional basis for allowing a search incident to arrest, which was taking control of the person's body and the access that that grants to police. Now, there are limits. As I said, even if you take control of a person's body, that doesn't mean that you can insert needles into their veins and draw their blood. And also, in Riley, when it came to the cell phone, they took control of the person's body and his phone, which was a personal effect on his person, but Robinson only went so far. It didn't extend to the person, to the data that was inside of the phone. In other words, in that case, I think the way to look at the cell phone in that case is that they could do a physical search. The court specifically said you could do a physical search for the various reasons set forth in Robinson, and also for the, you know, Kim L reasons, the rationales. But what you couldn't do is extend that search to the area inside of the cell phone, so to speak, and conceptualizing it in terms of a search incident to arrest, because he couldn't get access to that area.
But you're not suggesting the officers could follow Ellis, a Missouri Court of Appeals decision, rather than Gant or Riley or Robinson or Kimmel, I've always said. But rather that you think those other cases don't govern here.
Those other
cases,
because
clearly you'd have to follow the U.S. Supreme Court, not an incorrect Missouri Court of Appeals decision.
Certainly, Your Honor. But, you know, when the Missouri Court of Appeals is stating that Gant hasn't been extended to this particular kind of search, I think that officers could reasonably rely on that as a correct statement of Missouri law.
And anytime there's an incorrect Court of Appeals decision, it's automatically reasonable?
Well, I don't know if it's automatically reasonable, but, you know, they have to get their guidance from somewhere. And it's reasonable.
The U.S. Supreme Court, that's what I'm saying. If you get it from there, it's usually pretty secure.
But when a Missouri
whether or not it governs here.
Yeah, when a Missouri court specifically says Gant doesn't apply here.
But, I mean, I don't want to get in a fight. That couldn't, if in fact that was not reasonable to decide Gant didn't apply there, then otherwise you provide insulation always by having some incorrect decision, and there's always outlier decisions out there in the world.
I think so. We do provide some insulation to officers in this particular reason, because we recognize and consistently do so in these contexts that officers are not legal technicians.
Well, do we sometimes even expect our trial judges to follow our Court of Appeals decisions?
We do.
And what they say about Supreme Court cases?
We do.
And the question isn't what the cops did. The question is whether the lawyer's decision that there wasn't a makeable motion to suppress was reasonable. And more important than that, whether the motion court's decision that it was reasonable is clearly erroneous.
Yeah, and, you know, there are multiple layers there, as you say. I mean, you keep going down, and I think it is ultimately in this case, because we're dealing with a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, should counsel have reasonably thought, I can make this claim. Now, some might say, well, counsel could have looked at Gant and these other decisions and said these are actually the decisions that control. But I think counsel can also reasonably look at something and say, well, the Missouri Court of Appeals rejected that the last time an attorney tried this. It doesn't seem like it's going to bear fruit here.
And apparently we're all struggling with this very issue here today.
Right. It's not exactly, you know, clear cut in terms of how far Gant went or how far it should have gone. Carwell, I think, went some distance toward saying how far Gant should go in Missouri, but I don't think that's uniform across the nation. Now, of course, I've asked the court to reconsider that part of Carwell, but even if the court doesn't, you have a situation where counsel had to predict that Carwell would say what it said, and also that our courts would ultimately conclude, yeah, Gant did go that far. But even if you get there, and you get to the point where you say counsel should have done exactly what the attorney in Carwell did and should have raised this claim, it still ultimately doesn't show ineffective assistance of counsel, because what would have happened, as occurred in Carwell, is the court would have said, yeah, Gant applied, but the officer wouldn't have known that. The officer would have relied in good faith on pre-Carwell case law saying that the search was proper, so I'm still not going to suppress the evidence. So even if the attorney in this case had the foresight to raise this novel claim and argue that Gant really governed, the outcome would have been the same as occurred in Carwell, or at least it should have been, that the evidence, in fact, would not have been suppressed in the end because the officers relied in good faith on case law that existed prior to Carwell. And so even if you could say that counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, you can't reach the next step, which is Strickland prejudice, because the evidence still wouldn't have been suppressed. There would have been a development in the law for other people to follow later, but there wouldn't have been suppression of the evidence at this defendant's trial. Unless, of course, the court is going to reconsider the part of Carawell that says the exclusionary rule shouldn't have applied.
But then again, we'd have to predict that the lawyer should have predicted that we would overturn.
Get it wrong.
Right.
If you're going to reconsider that part of Carawell. Right.
And there wasn't a majority on that issue in Carawell, so talk to us about why it should be applied to other cases or not.
The way I read Carawell is that six members of the court agreed that the exclusionary rule should not apply. Four members of the court concluded that the search in Carawell violated the Fourth Amendment.
Didn't make him right. I just want to make sure.
I agree
that
with you, Your Honor.
If counsel's incompetent for not foreseeing Carawell, am I incompetent for disagreeing with it?
Certainly not. Mm-hmm. Certainly not.
I'd take the fifth.
I think that there is a rational basis to disagree on these legal questions, and I don't think it's at all clear. And so to suggest either that counsel should have known the answer and predicted it correctly, or that the officers should have known and shouldn't have been able to rely in good faith on pre-Carawell case law, goes too far, and the defendant's claim should be defeated for either one of those bases. But I also think that the court should take another look at whether Carawell is right. And, you know, of the four that said that search was unlawful, three said it was unlawful, but the officers relied in good faith on the law. There were three concurring judges who said, we think that the search was okay, but we agree with the outcome in the case because we don't think the evidence should be suppressed. So I would assume those...
I don't know what they would have said necessarily,
but in as much as they thought that the search itself was lawful, one would think that that would at least give rise to a good faith, reasonable finding on the officer's part. And of course, one member of the court both concurred and dissented and would have found both that it was unlawful and that the evidence should be suppressed. I guess the bottom line there is that I don't think the court got it wrong in terms of good faith, except insofar as I think that the need for good faith arose. I think that the court should have found that the search itself in Carawell was fine and there wasn't a need to turn to good faith.
But that'll be for another day because Carawell didn't exist at the time of this arrest, so it doesn't apply.
Right. For purposes of this particular case, it may be that that doesn't need to be resolved because the reasonableness of counsel's actions really should be looked at in terms of the laws that existed at the time counsel was making this determination. And here we are arguing and disputing over what really the state of the law was. Ellis said the state of the law allowed these kinds of searches and that Gantt had not yet been extended by any Missouri court or binding precedent. And I think it was reasonable for counsel and also officers to rely on that at the time the search occurred and at the time the trial took place.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'll just note, this isn't magic. This isn't ESP that we're asking you to recognize that counsel would have to have in order to be effective. The argument here is that at the time of the search, Carawell or no Carawell, at the time of this search, Gantt was good law, Kimmel was good law, Chadwick was good law, and it's ambiguous whether Robinson was good law. And so going in and Carawell, this court in Carawell, actually did answer that question, and that is that any reading of Robinson or any reading of case law that would allow unlimited by time and space personal effects searches on every arrest would not be permissible. And Carawell actually, by its own terms and the way that this court explained it, was not announcing a new rule. It noted, and I think I don't want to just read my brief off to you, but it noted that in 1969, Kimmel announced the rule. In 1977, Chadwick, quote, made it clear. And in 2009, Gantt, quote, reaffirmed it. It said that Gantt reiterated this rule. So this is not our position here is that this is not an ambiguous rule. And Gantt, the state relies a lot on Ellis coming out after Gantt. I would note that Ellis Ellis, on its own terms, the Eastern District did not actually address the question directly. In Ellis, they relied upon a good faith exception, and I think, you know, as a kind of meta discussion, we're inviting the parties to seek transfer on the case, and they never did. But Ellis does not stand for the proposition that Gantt does not apply. Ellis stood for the proposition that we are not going to apply it now because of this good faith exception. So I think that it's a lot less direct than we're getting from the state's position on that. At the time of this arrest, Gantt, from 2009, very explicitly limited searches incident to arrest to the area of the arrestee's immediate control and the arrestee's person. That was drawn from all the way back from when the rule was announced in Kimmel, which was connected to the justifications for the search incident to arrest, that being the reason that those rules were erected. And so not only should the officer not have performed that search, counsel should have been aware of Gantt, should have been aware of the existing case law, and which Carawell then reaffirmed and repeated later on. And so this was an effective counsel in this trial would have filed a motion to suppress the evidence on this basis, given the nature of the case law at the time, that motion should have been sustained.